Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me to give this talk. So the title is here. These are my collaborators and the papers. So just to give you the big picture, which is sort of clear from the title, okay, so the idea is we want to measure heavy particle masses. Okay, masses, of course, are Lorentz invariant quantities. But I'll show you how energy can be used, energy measured for the decay products, of course, can be used to measure masses of the parent particles. Okay? And again, this idea is novel because, of course, energy, it's not Lorentz invariant. And so your first reaction is, how can non-Lorentz invariant quantity, so namely energy of the decay products, how can that be used to robustly get to the masses of the decaying particle, okay, which is again Lorentz invariant. Okay, so as I already said, the basic goal is very simple. So I'll probably use the notation parent for the decaying particle and decay products, or sometimes I'll say child particles. Okay. And the green ones, I'll take them to be visible, usually, you know, standard model ones. And the red one is the invisible ones. Okay. So I measure energy momentum of these guys, and I want to get to the mass of the parent. But again, the goal is to do it in a sort of model independent way. What I mean by that is, I want to just use the kinematics of the decay as much as possible to get to the mass of the parent. Okay? And so again, have a measurement which is independent of the dynamics of the production. Okay? So that's the idea. so in short, I'll call it model independent measurements of masses. Okay? So of course, this this goal has been around for a long time, and so many techniques. And I just want to quickly run through some of them, just to give you an idea of what's out there. So of course, the issue is that there are many cases. So basically, there is no one technique which works universally. Okay, so the simplest case, which is actually also very rare, is when the heavy particle decays into two visible particles. That two leptons or photons, as in these two examples, the Higgs and the Z. So you just plot the invariant mass of the two decay products. And that, of course, gives you a nice peak, the Breitbinger resonance, and gives you the mass of the parent particle, again, independent of how the heavy particle was produced. Okay. But as I said, this is a very rare case. So just to move on, so let's take the example of the top quark, which is actually one of the heavy particles I'm going to come back to later for applying our method. So that decays into bottom W, and the W, of course, also decays. Okay? So in the case where both the Ws decay into jets, that's the one which is really fully visible, okay? But it does involve jets, so that makes it a little bit messy as opposed to just leptons and photons. But maybe more importantly, you have combinatorics to deal with, unlike the previous cases, okay? Because let's say I can even tag the B jets, so that's fine. I can distinguish these from these. But there are four non-B jets, and there are obviously many ways of pairing them to form the Ws, okay? And then in addition, what I'm not shown here is, of course, jets from initial state radiation that make that combinatorics problem even worse. And then moving on, there are cases where you don't fully observe the final state. So again, the same example, TT bar, but let's say one of the Ws goes into a lepton, then you miss the neutrino. Okay, but it turns out, and I'll probably come back to this again later, that in this case, if I have only one invisible particle, okay, I can still try to get to the top mass by reconstructing this decay chain. Okay, namely, for the neutrino, I do know its transverse momentum because that's just the missing transverse momentum or MET. Okay, and then the longitudinal momentum of the neutrino, I can solve for it by imposing what is called the W mass constraint. So assuming that the lepton and that single invisible particle, neutrino, came from a W decay. And then once you have the W reconstructed, I can combine it with the B, form the invariant mass, just like we did for the Higgs and the Z. Okay. But the issue is, again, there are discrete ambiguities and combinatorics, because even if I get the W, I don't know whether to combine it with this B or that B. Okay. And then just moving on, there are cases where something like this happens. So let's say supersymmetry, squarks giving quarks and neutralinos, and this object is completely missed on this side and on the other side. Of course, I'm assuming R parity is conserved and so on. Okay, so, but even in this case, of course, people have come up with techniques to measure the mass of the squark, just observing the jets and the MET, and there are various techniques. MT2 is one, something called Razor and so on. Okay, MT2 also, of course, makes use of MET, and this Razor has some assumptions about the boosts of the parent particle. Okay, so really the bottom line is here that it's always useful to come up with more techniques, which might be simpler and complementary. For example, if you can come up with techniques which can avoid making use of the missing energy, that would be nice. Okay, so as I said already, the techniques here and here you do use, you need to measure MET. Okay, okay. So again, it's okay to use MET, but the issue is that when you're using MET, you are sensitive to the entire event, okay? So you'd better make sure that every other particle in the event, which has nothing to do with this decay, you'd better measure its energy and momentum accurately, because that will impact, you know, the measurement of the decay that you're focusing on, okay? Okay, so, so then the idea behind the talk is, first I'm going to tell you about a new observation about actually kinematics of two-body decays to begin with, and then apply it to measure masses. Okay. Okay, so again, to begin with, this simple two-body decay, little a is my child particle, which I'm going to assume it's massless, visible, and the capital A is the invisible guy. I'm going to label the parent capital B, and this capital A might be invisible or maybe partially visible. In our technique, we basically don't care, except we're going to use its mass. Okay, so so for example, in the case of the top going to bottom W, this guy would be the W. So I'm going to assume the W mass, but I'm not going to reconstruct the W. So that's what I mean by that. Okay. okay. And but a crucial assumption, you'll see why I need to make it, is that I'm going to assume that this parent particle is produced unpolarized, okay? And then maybe if there is time, I'll talk about how to generalize this to three body and so on, okay? Okay, the starting point, so again, just remember this capital B going to little a and capital A. Little a is massless, that's the guy I'm observing. So the energy of the little a, that visible massless child particle, in the rest frame of the parent particle, has this simple formula, just following from energy momentum conservation, okay? So again, single value. So this means that if I could somehow measure the energy of the visible particle in the rest frame of the parent, I can get a combination of masses of the parent and the other child particle. So if you wish, if I know the mass of the other decay product, then I can get the mass of the parent, okay? But of course, as I already said, Energy is not Lorentz invariant quantity. And so it seems that you know, this formula is correct, but it's not of much use, okay? Because the point is that the parent is going to have a boost in the lab frame, okay? So the lab frame is not the rest frame of the parent particle. In particular, if I go to a hadron collider, the boost of the parent changes event to event, and for a given event, you don't know what it is a priori, okay? And so, and hopefully it's clear that the simple picture in the rest frame, so single value for the energy of that visible child particle, and what I'm plotting here is just the number of events, that basically that delta function will get smeared, so I'll get some distribution, non-trivial distribution, of the energy of the visible child particle in the lab frame. Okay, so this is what I measure. So it seems that, again, this picture was nice. It gave you the mass of the parent. But it seems I've kind of lost that information in the lab frame, okay, because that's what I see, okay, the smear delta function. And again, this is the reason why energy had not so far been used to measure masses. But what we find remarkably is that so again, this is true, but if you look at the location of the peak of this energy distribution, okay, again, the same one that I had here, just looking at the location of the peak, that that location of the peak is actually same as the value of the energy in the rest frame of the parent, okay, namely that combination of masses, okay. And I'll, of course, show you the proof in a second, but I want to highlight here that it's a precise statement. Okay, so again, if you wish going back, yes, the delta function is smeared, but in such a way that the location of the peak remains the same. Okay, okay, and again, it's a precise statement given those assumptions, and also I want to say it's robust, meaning this result is independent of the distribution of the boost of the parent particle. Okay, so just to show this in this cartoon, I'll you know, later I'll show actual calculations. But let's say I go from the Tevatron to the LHC, let's say for top quark. Then obviously, as I go to higher energy collider, typical boost of the parent particle is going to be higher, okay, at LHC compared to Tevatron. So therefore, the distribution of the energy of the child particle is going to get broader as I go from Tevatron to LHC, okay. And again, that's just a reflection of the fact that energy is not Lorentz invariant, so the energy distribution does change, okay. But what we are finding is that even though the distribution changes, the location of the peak actually remains the same at the Tevatron versus the LHC, and that value is this simple combination of masses.
How much is it affected by background? Because in principle, when you do background subtraction, you can see.
Sure. So So I should say So this is all pure signal. So of course, background is an issue for any measurement method, right? So. Yeah, so I'll talk about the specific application to the top mass, and there I will show you that in that particular case, the cuts in the background basically don't significantly change this result. No, that's actually hard. So the only thing roughly I can say that is, I mean, the obvious point that the width of this distribution is just somehow proportional to the typical boost of the parent, but it's hard to be more precise about that relation. So again, the width gives you some idea of the typical boost of the parent, but so first I'll prove this result and then apply it to, as I already said, the top quark mass. I mean, there are some steps here. Let me just go through it when I get there. And then maybe quickly show application, slightly modified one for new physics case with a cascade decay instead of just one two-body decay. And maybe if there is time, I'll briefly talk about three-body. Okay. Okay, so let me prove this sort of result. And we called it invariance because of this feature here, that the location of peak is invariant under change in the distribution of the boosts of the parent. Okay. Okay, so the proof is really simple, just three slides actually. So let me first begin with a parent produced with a fixed magnitude of boost, okay, but doesn't matter what size of the boost. So, okay, arbitrary but fixed. Okay. And I'm going to call that beta of the B, the capital B. So let's look at the picture. So here's the rest frame where the two child particles are going in opposite direction, and then this parent particle is boosted in some other direction in the lab frame. Okay. So there is an angle here, okay, between those two directions. That I'm going to vary, okay? But keep the magnitude fixed, okay? And this is where the assumption about the unpolarized parent comes in. So I'm going to make that choice. And because of that, you can show that the cosine of this angle has a flat distribution between minus 1 and 1, okay? The probability is constant between minus 1 and 1. And of course, that angle or cosine is relevant because that's what enters the usual boost formula or Lorentz transformation for the energy. So here's what I measure. Here's the value in the rest frame, which was simply related to the masses. And these are the boosts and so on. Okay? And so based on this, it's clear that for, again, fixed boost of the parent, the distribution I get looks like this. So I'm just going to call it a rectangle. Okay. So again, this is the measured energy in the lab frame. And one thing to note is that the endpoints are given like that. Using that formula. So what it means is that just looking at the endpoint, that the value of the energy in the rest frame is always covered by this rectangle, okay, no matter what the size of the boost of the parent. Okay? In fact, you can see that the value of the rest energy is actually the geometric mean of the endpoints of that rectangle. Okay, so that means if I plot energy on a logarithmic scale, then the value of the rest energy is going to be sitting right in the middle. Okay. So there is that result that for every value of beta, the rest energy is covered, and of course the rectangle, so it's a flat distribution. Okay. And of course, what you see is that if I make the beta of the mother or the parent smaller, then the rectangle is going to shrink and eventually is going to converge on this value here. Okay? So which means this rest energy is the unique value of the energy which is covered by every rectangle. So basically, I'm done. So this was a fixed boost with these properties. Now imagine a distribution of boosts of the parent particle. So I'm going to get a stacking up of rectangles. Okay. Again, the longer rectangles are coming from the larger boost. The thinner rectangles are coming from a small boost. But all of them contain this rest energy. And again, if you want to say it mathematically, that's the unique energy which has this feature, that every boost of the parent particle covers that energy. Okay? So stacking up these rectangles, you see that there is a peak, which is exactly at the value of the energy in the rest frame. Okay? And again, what is crucial is that basically it doesn't matter what is the distribution of the boosts of the mother, of the parent. The boost distribution, of course, is going to decide the relative weights given to these rectangles. Okay, so here I've just put in some arbitrary weight, but you see that this result is independent of what weights you assign to this versus that versus that. Okay. And again, this is good because, of course, the boost distribution depends on many other things, the production mechanism, so the complete model, dynamics, and also PDFs and so on, okay, and collider energy and so on. But the point is that the peak being here is independent of all those details, production mechanism, PDFs, and so on. Okay. So again, the one thing I am assuming about the production mechanism is that the parent is produced unpolarized. Okay. Okay, so that's the main result. But let me just comment a little bit about what type of boost distributions you may have in actual cases. So if I look at pair production of the heavy particles, so something like a 2-to-2 process, okay, which is what I was implicitly assuming earlier. So the top quark is an example like that. So in that case, if I look at the distribution of the boosts of the parent, okay, so again, that's what I'm now plotting here. So number of events, but this is boost of the parent, okay, not to be confused with the energy distribution of the child particle. Okay, so the point is, of course, this just goes from 0 to 1, but because it's 2 to 2, you can show that the probability to produce the heavy particle exactly at zero boost, so beta equal to zero, is actually zero, okay? But if I go a little bit away from zero, then the probability is non-vanishing, even if small. So that's how it looks like, okay? So that means, going back, the limit of the thin rectangle, namely the delta function, that contribution is not there for the 2-to-2 production. That's why I didn't show it here, okay? But you do have contribution from very, very thin rectangle. So it turns out that that is good enough to give a P, okay? And I'll show an actual plot in a second. Okay? Now there is a case where you produce a single parent, so 2-to-1, for example, Higgs production, okay, without any extra jets and so on. So in that case, the probability to have the parent particle with zero boost is actually non-zero. Okay, so it might start here. Maybe it goes up, comes down, or maybe it falls, it doesn't matter. The point is that zero boost, the probability is non-zero. So in that case, sorry, you do get the contribution from the delta function, okay? So that yellow contribution, the limiting contribution. And so in that case, you can see that, of course, there is still the peak, but there is even a derivative discontinuity at the location of the peak, okay, or a kink. Now, of course, you can cook up a case where you might actually have a gap in the distribution of the boost of the parent particle. So it doesn't start out at zero, but it starts out at some non-zero beta. Okay, and this is a bit unlikely, but for completeness sake, I list it here. So in this case, of course, what will happen is you don't even have the contribution from the thin rectangle, okay? So this is supposed to be dashed, meaning it's missing. So in that case, you get more like a plateau, okay? So not a peak as such, right? So, but anyway, this is a little bit cooked up. So I would say the generic situations are either the peak with the kink. So either this one, peak with the kink, or the one I showed here. Okay. So I promised to show some actual plots, not just cartoons. So here's the first one. So again, hopefully you're convinced about this result that the location of the peak of this massless decay product is the same as the value of the energy in the rest frame. But okay, here's an actual computation. I don't really need it, but okay, you might as well do it. So again, I'm gonna take the top quark decay and look at the bottom. Now, of course, the bottom mass is not zero, but you can show that the effect of that small mass is really negligible, okay? Of course, the location of the peak or the value in the rest frame It's going to get a small correction like this, okay? But apart from that, nothing else changes. Okay, so this is the result of the actual calculation. Okay, putting in the PDFs and everything, and at LHC7. Okay, so this was, I think, done using MATGraph with sort of infinite statistics. That's why this curve here is a little bit thick. Anyway, so what you find is that the peak, just by eye, you can see that it is where you expect it from our result, namely this combination of masses is about 68 GeV, and that's where you find the peak. Okay. Now, you might say, so I really don't need this, but anyway, you might say maybe this was an accident at LHC7, and so just to show you that, no, actually it's a robust feature that there is an invariance here. So here what I'm showing is, again, the same process, top production, plotting the energy of the B, but changing the center of mass energy of the collider, even changing the nature of the collider. Okay, so I've included a Tevatron, so PP bar, and then LHC and a future 100 TV. This is just so this is just actually just parton level. So I'll come back to putting in cuts and so on. Okay. Anyway, so you see that the but this is actual calculation as opposed to the cartoons I was drawing. So this is just to show you that it actually works. Okay. So so again, the distribution gets broader as I raise the energy, but the peak is unchanged. And here's another way to show the same thing or similar feature, fixing the collider energy but changing the energy of the initial state radiation. Okay, so as I do that, I do change the distribution of the boost of the top, but again, you find that the peak remains the same. So just to say that if I try the same thing for the transverse momentum or transverse energy, it doesn't work, meaning the peak does shift. Okay. All right, so let me move on to sort of application. Again, the idea is what I already said. So again, plot the energy of the massless child particle, find the location of the peak, and equate it to that combination. And then if you know MA, you can get MB, or in general, you'll just get a combination of the masses. Again, the assumption is unpolarized parent, but otherwise it's independent of the production mechanism. Okay. So now, even before I get to background and so on, there's already an issue which you can see from, let's say, this plot here, that the peak is kind of, broad. Okay, so it's not like a Z resonance, Breitwigner peak in the dileptron invariant mass. So one issue is that even given pure signal, how do you extract the peak accurately, the location of the peak? Okay. Okay, so that's what I mean here. Now, even in the case of the Breitwigner resonance, so Z going to lepton, you of course don't read the peak off by just the eye. What you do is you fit to the Breitwigner curve, okay, the theory curve, which of course is a model independent function, a simple function, just two parameters, the mass of the particle and the decay width of that particle, okay, and it's of course computed from first principles, so analytic and so on. Now, ideally, you would like to do something like that even for this energy peak, but of course, that's almost impossible because, as already said, the even though the location of the peak is invariant, the rest of the distribution is not invariant. Okay, it depends on boost distribution, PDF, and so on. Okay, so obviously, you cannot play the game of Breitwigner. Okay. Again, that's because Breitwigner was for invariant mass, and here it's energy, which is not Lorentz invariant. Okay, but still, we realize that you might be able to get a good approximation. Okay, because we do know some properties of the rest of the distribution from first principles. Okay, so let me just quickly go through this. So I'm going to denote the distribution by F. This energy distribution, and I'm going to plot it as a function of this x, which is just the energy in the lab frame divided by the energy in the rest frame. Okay, so and again, this value here is that simple combination of masses. So obviously, one result is that the peak is at x equal to 1. Okay, but But the other result is that this distribution is actually remains unchanged when I take x2 1 over x. Okay? And the reason for that is just this symmetry of the distribution on the log scale that I pointed out earlier. Okay? That again, the value of the rest energy is the geometric mean of the endpoint. So if I plot energy on the log scale, this value is right in the middle. That statement is true for every rectangle, and therefore it is true for the whole distribution. Okay? So that is this whole distribution. If I plot energy on the log scale, then the peak, which is the value of the rest energy, is the midpoint. Okay? So that fact just implies this, I mean, it's equivalent to this statement. Okay? You know, this is just on the linear scale, so that's how it looks like. Anyway, so, and then the other point is, of course, I do expect the distribution to go to zero as x goes to zero or infinity. And so based on that, we actually just came up with an ansatz for what the theory curve might be. Again, the idea was to get an approximation. Okay, so here was our proposal. Again, the guiding principle was simplicity, but we also wanted to connect it to first principles, and that's why this fitting function is a function only of this combination here, x plus 1 over x, based on that property that we could show from first principle. Okay? And this is just normalization, so forget the fact that it's a Bessel function. Okay? And then maybe this was not good notation, but anyway, this is what we use in our paper. So of course, there is a parameter which basically encodes the width of that energy distribution, which we call it little p. And we took it to be an exponential, obviously, just so that the distribution would die off at x equal to 0 and infinity. Okay? So think of it as a peak finder, definitely not unique, but simple and sort of tied to the first principle. Okay? So the amazing thing was, well, it was initially it was just an ansatz, but then we fit it to the actual theory curve. Okay, so this orange line is what I showed you earlier. Okay, the same thing. So remember, again, the goal is to get the peak accurately, this guy, and that's when we are using this fitting function. So this purple curve is exactly that fitting function. Of course, it has two parameters in it: this little p, which stands for the width, and just to be clear, the x contains the second parameter, which is the location of the peak, right? So the variable is really this, and that's the second parameter. So what I mean by this fit is vary those two parameters, find the best fit to the theory curve. Okay, so the you see that it's a nice fit. Okay, so that suggests that this is a good approximation to the actual theory curve. Okay. And we've tried this for many cases, so not just the top quark, let's say at LHC7, but also tried for a heavier top quark at LHC7, which of course has a different boost distribution, okay, and therefore a different width of this energy distribution. But still, the same function seems to do a good fit. Of course, each time it's going to give you a different value of this little p. Because in each case, the width of that energy distribution is going to be different, because again, that depends on the boost distribution of the parent. Okay? And then we have tried it for the gluino and so on as well. So it seems that that function that I showed seems to be powerful enough that, you know, with this parameter here, I'm actually able to, encompass different boost distribution of the parent. So our proposal is that this could be used as a fitting function to the actual data to extract the peak. Okay. Right.
So what happens if the Gluino cascades to something first, the spork, and then the spork is the thing that it is?
So in fact, I'll actually talk about that example later. So then I have the squark, which I would call a secondary parent, if you wish.
You'll have two peaks.
Exactly, yeah. So you're,
yeah.
I'll show you. Yeah. Okay, so just maybe just wait a little bit. Okay, so so this was really just theory, again, no cuts, no background, but the idea again was that this function can be used to extract the peak. I mean, kind of like the Breit-Wigner formula is used to extract the peak of the Z or the Higgs, okay? Okay, so then you might say, what about cuts and so on? So we went through that process. So again, applying it to the top quark. And of course, in this case, I do know the W mass very well, you know, much more accurately than the top quark. So I'm going to assume that as given. So the idea is plot the energy of the distribution of B, find the peak using that formula, that fitting function, and stick it in here and get the top mass. Okay? And here are some of the details. I mean, so the usual thing, we did include detector simulations as much as we could, Pythia and so on. But the key thing here is, and again, this is LHC7, 5 inner center band, but we actually chose the opposite flavor dileptron event. Okay? So where one W decays into electron, the other one to muon. And the reason for that is, and we require 2 B tags. The reason for that is in that channel, the background is actually very small. Okay, so here are the rough numbers. Okay, so again, here you are kind of lucky, in this case, I can basically ignore the background. Actually, related to that, I mean, you're asking about cuts. So the point is that this signal to background is big, so the background is sort of few percent, even with only a mild choice of cuts. Okay, of course, I can impose very hard cuts and I can get a high signal or background. Okay, but as you already anticipated, if I put cuts, then I might sculpt the distribution, change the peak. Okay, so the trade-off is I don't want to put very hard cuts. At the same time, I want to suppress background. Okay, so that's the competition. And here it works out that in this EMU 2 B tag channel, just mild cuts are enough. So mild cuts meaning, I mean, you'll see on the next slide, just, you know, PT of the BZ bigger than 20 GeV or whatever, right? Okay, so that's why just to have this, you know, in principle application, we neglected background. But again, in this channel, the background actually is small, okay? So here's the result. So again, these dots are the simulated data via that process I outlined. This one pseudo experiment, and the blue curve is the fit to the simulated data using, again, our function here, the job of which was to extract the peak. As I already mentioned, we imposed the minimum, you know, basic cuts, so something like PT of the B gen bigger than 20. That's why you see that, again, this is energy of the B, but because of that, you see that the distribution actually starts, let's say, around 20 GeV. Of course, the peak is at 70, so what we are making use of is that those basic cuts are, if you wish, well away from the peak. Okay, so peak is at 70, and that's 20 GeV. Okay? Anyway, so because of that, we actually said that just use the region near the peak. So the blue dots are the ones we used in our fit, okay? Not the red ones, okay? Because as I said, the cuts remove this, and by the symmetry, I should then try to, you know, not use these very high energy events. In any case, the statistics here and here is low. It's statistics is maximum here, so this makes sense. Okay, so again, do the fitting, extract the peak, convert that to top mass using that simple formula. And the point here is that it seems to work. So the output top mass is consistent with the input value. I think the input value was 173, so within the error, it's totally fine. And the size of the error is also not bad. It's around 3 GeV. And just to summarize, this is saying that at least in this case, the you know, the mild cuts or detector effects, to the extent that we could simulate them, don't seem to spoil the location of the peak. Okay, and again, the background is small in this particular channel. So, Yeah, so we actually, let's see. So I think, yeah, so we didn't actually, so you could try to use some different peak finder, right?
No, no, no. In the sense of,
or you mean ranges of fitting?
Different.
So we did try different ranges. So you can change the fitting range, right? So, I mean, you need to choose it around 70, but you can choose.
Just on what systematic error are the cuts and tech effects and backgrounds giving you on your map? So the 2.8 is being statistical.
So this is, I think, mostly statistical, I think.
Okay, so the systematics are lower than that.
What we did was, we, as I said, tried changing the fitting range. That doesn't really change the result. Oh, so we didn't vary the cuts.
It could be kind of luck that here the various effects don't change the peak too much.
But you mean changing the cuts? What do you want? I mean,
for example, the effect was 70.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Let me rephrase the question. Okay. For example, right? So what happens if the signal you're looking at here has a lot of statistics, right?
Right.
Where, of course, the mass will be much heavier, but still, you have to place stringent cuts on your background
right.
to be able to reduce them.
Yeah,
so what happens in that case, for example? Right?
Well, I'll come back to that, but. What would be the source? I mean, I'm just wondering. So this was, phenomenologist way of doing it. So of course, I'm going to show you results of CMS doing it actually, the same method. Okay. So,
yeah. So there should be systematic error having to do, maybe it's very small, having to do with the cuts you place. Because the shape of what you fit.
So you mean? Right, so you mean you want to change the cuts and see.
So
that effect we tried, and that was small.
Okay.
But of course, you don't want to make the cuts, it's clear what I said earlier, right? If you make the cuts harder, eventually you're going to change the, you're going to sculpt the distribution, right? So, I mean, it's clear, you don't want to change, I mean, you don't want to make the cuts, you don't want to suddenly go to very hard cuts, because that will clearly change everything, right? Okay? So, but we did try so mild cuts, so whether PT is minimum PT of the BJ is 20 or 15, that doesn't change anything. Now, if you make it, of course, closer to 70, then of course it's going to right, it's going to change.
For a given process, how do you decide where the line between one and the
test? So of course in the top core case we kind of understand the dynamics, right? So already if it's some new heavy particle, I think you'll have to kind of go back and forth. So So I'll show you the results with the gluino. So there, of course, I'm kind of assuming that that the model is, there's a gluino there, and that suggests what sort of cuts to put, right? So very quickly, just some discussion before I go on to showing the CMS result. So one thing I've neglected is F final state radiation. Okay, so where there is hard radiation from the B, that kind of makes it a three-body decay. And therefore, my result doesn't apply. But luckily, because it's hard radiation, it is down by something like alpha s over pi, so at the few percent level. Okay, so of course I can compute what is the effect with QC reproduction, and that's what is in progress. So again, soft radiation doesn't really change the peak because it doesn't change the two-bodiness of the decay. And initial state radiation is also not an issue because that does change the distribution of the boost of the top, but that doesn't change the location of the peak. Okay? So, and again, there is obviously I'm not combining anything. So the 2Bs are doing their job independently. So in a given event, I'm going to tag both the Bs. So both Bs are going to be part of that distribution, again, but independently. And again, just to summarize, assuming the top is produced unpolarized, other than that, I'm not sensitive to the details of production mechanism, PDFs, and maybe there is new physics in the production of the top, but as long as it produces unpolarized top, this method still works. Okay. Now you might say, why do I need another method? Okay. So let me just quickly tell you a little bit about that motivation. And again, I'm going to simplify the comparison. So general point, of course, is that it is good to have different methods. You know, you can cross-check the results from the different methods. Okay. But in the case of the top mass, it's a little bit subtle. So let me just go through that. Okay. So again, we started out applying it to the top as a test. If you wish, in preparation for applying it to new particles. But then actually since then, we realized that it is really or could be a serious measurement. Okay, and so let me try to explain why there is a need for a method of the type that we are proposing. Okay, so let me talk about first theoretical issues with the existing methods, comparing it to what we say. So of course, in all of this, I'm still going to assume the decay is as in the standard model, so bottom W. Okay. But the point is that in the production, there could be new physics, so there could be uncertainties in general, and I'm going to call that delta production. Okay. So the relative uncertainty in the production. Okay. So it's a dimensionless number. Okay. Smaller than one, likely. Okay. And another small parameter I'm going to talk about is this effect of the final state radiation, which is what I had here. Okay, so this alpha s over pi, and maybe even further suppressed if I could employ a jet veto. Okay, and then in general, of course, the new physics could produce polarized top. So let me call that fraction little f. Okay, okay, but the point is that the existing methods, actually most of them at least, for measuring the top quark mass, in one way or another, they are assuming that the top quark was produced by purely standard model. Okay, so they are assuming the standard model matrix element. Okay, so that means if there is delta amount of, let's say, new physics, then in principle, those methods could encounter an error in the top mass of as big as the size of the uncertainty in the production, the size of the new physics, let's say. Okay, so just to be concrete, suppose I say that the amount of new physics in production of TT bar, let's say, is few percent, then those methods which actually assume pure standard model matrix element might in principle be making an error of up to few percent. Okay, okay, because again, if you wish, you assume the wrong matrix element at the few percent level. Okay. Whereas our case is slightly different. So of course, if the new physics produces polarized top, then our idea, so this B-jet energy peak, we will face the full brunt of the fraction of polarized top. Okay? But just for the moment, let me assume that the tops are still unpolarized, but there is some uncertainty, new physics or PDF or whatever. Okay? So what you see is that, again, assuming unpolarized top, that if delta is the size of uncertainty, our method is not affected at leading order in delta, okay? because of the invariance of the location of the P, okay? Again, assuming unpolarized storm, okay? So it's only after I apply the FSR factor from the radiation that the peak shifts, so, okay? And so that's the size of the error we would encounter, okay? So again, this is at the theory level, so ignoring cuts and so on, okay? All right. So just to be clear, the effect of the hard radiation from the bottom quark, that effect on the QCD part of the production, or the standard model part of the production, that is not an error because that can be computed. And again, that's what that's what we are doing right now. Okay, so computing this in QCD. Okay, so it's really the hard radiation correction, if you wish, applied to the new physics part of the production. That is our error, okay? So, but you see that it's suppressed by these two factors, okay? So again, very likely delta production itself is few percent, okay? But we are not sensitive at that few percent level. We are sensitive at few percent times another few percent, okay? So if you wish, there is a screening of the effect of new physics by this factor, as compared to the traditional method, okay? All right, so, but let me actually just comment a little bit more about that. I mean, I said that most of the methods assume standard model matrix element, but you might say, what if I try to do the full reconstruction of the decay of the top? And this is the example I was giving earlier, okay? So again, reconstruct the neutrino, assuming that there's a W, then try to combine it with the B, okay? But as I already said, you face combinatorics factor of two, because even if I get the W, I don't know which B to combine it with. Even before that, when you solve for the neutrino longitudinal momentum, it turns out it's a quadratic equation, so there is a twofold ambiguity, okay? So that means for each event, I mean, the bottom line is you get four values of the top quark mass in quotes, okay? Of course, only one of them is right, the other three are wrong. So only the correct one obviously peaks at M top, and the wrong combinations, obviously there's a distribution of them, okay, because they're wrong combinations. So so their value can, you know, it's going to be of order M top, but it's going to be spread, okay. So that means what you see, of course, is the combined thing, the wrong plus the right combination. So it's clear, okay, let me not go through all these plots, but it's clear that what you measure, the peak in that is going to be shifted from the true value of the top quark mass. Okay, again, because of the wrong combination. Okay, so so because of that, what the experimental analysis do is to get around this combinatorics. They simply roll the dice, if you wish. So they simulate what is the probability of the wrong combinations. But of course, if you do that, you've got to assume a matrix element. And so the default is assume the standard model, okay? So really what they do is assume standard model, compute the total distribution of this invariant mass, wrong plus the right combination, and then fit it to the data. So of course, compute the distribution as a function of M top, fit it to the data, find the best fit, okay? So, but that means that that value M top that you get is strictly valid only in the standard model, okay, not if there is new physics in the product. Okay, and then very quickly, let me just say that suppose I assume it's standard model production, there's sort of an issue as to what is the, you know, what is the physical meaning of the top quark you're measuring, okay? Now there are a bunch of masses floating around. So there's pole versus MS bar mass, that relation is well known, okay, so that's not the issue, okay? But the issue is these methods of top mass measurement, what mass are they measuring, okay? Now, our B-jet energy peak, you can see at least at leading order, it's really getting the pole mass because it's based on kinematics, okay? Purely kinematics, okay? That is, I don't need to rely on simulation or, you know, in part on shower and so on. Whereas all the other methods, you see that they're simulating from the get-go, and so you are more sensitive to, you know, any uncertainties or effects coming from simulation. Okay, so that's why often the mass measured by the usual methods, which again from the beginning rely on simulation, It's often given a name Monte Carlo mass because that's what is the mass or parameter in your MAD graph or you know Pithia or whatever. Okay. Let's see. So actually, how much? I've lost track of time. Okay. Okay. 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Okay, let me, I won't go through this in detail, but so that was sort of the theory issues with the methods of top mass measurement. The other one, of course, is experimental. So so just to give you a flavor for this, so some of the other methods do make use of MET, okay? So for example, when I'm doing this, when I'm including a neutrino, as I already said, its transverse momentum is the MET, okay? So that means you're sensitive to, you know, what the rest of the event is doing, meaning you need to measure all of the other particles which have nothing to do with this decay, but you need to measure all the other particles' energies accurately. Okay? So whereas our method clearly doesn't make use of MET, so again, it's different systematics. Of course, we are impacted by the jet energy scale uncertainty because we're using only the B-jet. Okay? Whereas the other method uses, it does use B-jet, but it uses also lepton. So the impact of the Jess uncertainty is diluted a little bit. Okay. In order to address this, let me just say this. I won't explain any details. One idea is that the energy of the bottom quark, which is really what we want to measure, that also manifests itself as a boost in the decay length of the B hadron. The bottom quark hadronizes, there's a B jet, in that is a B hadron. You can measure its decay length, and of course, that is larger than the proper decay length of the B hadron because the B hadron was boosted in turn because the bottom quark was boosted. Okay, so that's what I mean by using the decay length as a proxy for the bottom quark energy. And again, the idea is this way you're not actually measuring the energy in the calorimeter. So you avoid the Jess uncertainty. You are instead sensitive to the spatial resolution of the detector. So again, different systematic. Okay? So that's the idea. So I had a couple of slides on this decay length, but let me skip it. So just to jump to the CMS result, so they actually implemented it on the run one data. And here's the result they get. Okay, so of course, they were obviously much more careful than what we did. So they included, you know, many types of systematics. So the error, if you roughly combine, it is of order, let's say 3 GeV, whereas the other methods, if you use the current world average, the error on that is about 1 GeV. Okay. So the error from this measurement, it's a little bit bigger than this, although comparable. Okay. But again, the idea is that our method is complementary. For example, the other methods to assume standard model production of the top quark, whereas we are less sensitive to that assumption. Okay. Yeah, so now I think the issue is, so statistics is also there at 1 GeV, that will go down with more data. But the systematic, the dominant effect seems to be these two mentioned here. So that's the jet energy scale, and that's where our idea of B decay length might help. Okay. And I had those two slides on that method, but I can talk about it later. And actually, it turns out that the other error here is, so it has to do with modeling of the top quark transverse momentum. Okay. Let me skip that just to say that that might be addressed if there is a higher order theory calculation. Okay. So basically the point is we have some thoughts about how to try to reduce that error. Okay. Okay. So let me then quickly, in maybe 5 minutes, talk about new physics application. So again, the idea was once we have tested it on the top mass, we are now ready to apply it. So just for a variation, I'm going to look at the cascade decay which was mentioned. I mean, the simple case of just one two-body decay, there's nothing new to say, right? I mean, even here, there's not much new to say, but it's actually interesting, as you'll see. Okay, so think about a process like this. So here's my primary parent, bigger circle, going into a secondary, plus a visible, and then this going to that. So of course, classic example is gluino going to quark, squark, squark going to another quark, and the neutralino. Okay. And so I'm going to assume that this guy is on shell, so it's a really cascade of two bonds. Okay. So the same picture written as a Feynman diagram, if you wish. Okay. So clearly, the energy distribution of this guy has a peak whose location gives you a combination of these two masses. Right, that's one here. The energy of this guy gives you a combination of these two masses. Okay. But remember, I have three unknown masses, okay? Capital C, B, and A, okay? Unlike the top quark where the capital A was a W and a new H mass, okay? So I need one more relation. So just the two energy peaks are not enough. okay? So then we combine the two energy peaks with looking at the invariant mass of these two particles, the visible particles, and looking at the endpoint. That endpoint is also a combination of masses. Okay. So of course, this idea is old. Okay. So, but the point is that this invariant mass endpoint does provide a third independent measurement of the combination of the masses. Okay. So that's what I mean here. So I now combining our two energy peaks here and here with the endpoint in the invariant mass does give you what you need for measuring all three unknown masses, okay? So that means in principle, I can get the invisible mass, so the capital A, without measuring the MET, okay? And, you know, I kind of found that interesting because usually, in fact, in any other method where you try to get to the neutralino mass or the invisible particle mass, you kind of have to use MET. And the reason, of course, is clear that, you know, the telltale sign of a heavy invisible particle is the MET, okay? So somehow you need to use the MET to get to its mass. But here it turns out just the visible particle information is enough to get the invisible particle mass. Okay, so anyway, so we did try it out on this case, like I said, gluino to bottom. And so in this case, you do get a double peak, okay? And so this is again a cartoon of that. Okay, one from the first decay, the gluino decay, the other one from the bottom decay. So if you're lucky, then the two peaks might be separated. So let's say in hierarchy like this, which is maybe what is motivated by the current limits. So gluino bottom squark are heavy, maybe closer in mass, okay? And the neutralino could be much lighter, okay? So the peak from this decay could be much higher. The peak from here is lower, okay? And okay, we dealt with the background. So the usual trade-off, so we had to choose cuts to reduce the background, at the same time, try not to shift the peak, okay? And in this case, again, we did manage to come up with a set of cuts which does that job, okay? So these are some old plots, but never mind, they illustrate the idea, okay? So again, the dots are the result of the simulation with, it's 300 inverse 7 to 1, it's LHC14, and those curves are again the fitting the same function that I already used for the top mass to get this energy peak and that energy peak, and here's the endpoint in the invariant mass of the two bottom quarks, and the result, I don't know if you can see, these are the measurements. So of course the errors here are going to be obviously bigger, fractional error, than we could achieve for the top quark, mainly because the background here is going to be obviously bigger, or the S over B is going to be not as big as we had earlier. So I think here the numbers are S over B of 10, whereas in the top quark case, it was more like 100. Anyway, so But this shows, so again, this peak is from the secondary parent decay, so the bottom squark decay, which has a different boost distribution than the primary parent, namely the gluino. Okay? But our conclusion is that the same fitting function seems to actually work even for the boost distribution of a secondary parent. Okay? It seems to work based on the extraction of the masses being, you know, reasonable. Yes. Yeah, I think by now it's probably, So of course I was imagining that the first two generation squarks are very heavy.
Oh, yes, sorry, yes.
Well, yeah. Actually, but yeah, you may remember. So if I decouple the first two generation squarks, 1000 GeV is still, it's 1.4, okay.
It's pretty impressive. But yeah, okay.
So old plant, okay. I'm almost run out of time. Okay, but let me just quickly say that, let me talk about this. So suppose I have a three-body decay with two visible guys, okay? So take the same Suzy example, but make this bottom off-shell, so heavy, okay? Then I get two B-jets, but it's a three-body decay. So then the idea here would be I can slice the three-body phase space into many two-body slices, subspaces, whatever. Okay, that is, if I fix the invariant mass of the two visible child particles, so the two bottoms, then for all events in that category, it is like a two-body decay, obviously. Okay, and then I repeat it for a different slice of invariant mass of the two Bs. And then in the end, I combine. Okay, so that's the idea, and that's what we tried here. Actually, let me say this very quickly because it's slightly different, and then wrap up. So suppose I do a three-body decay, but with only one visible. Okay, so as distinct from this one where I had two visible. Okay, so again, two invisible and one visible. So now I really just have the energy of that visible particle to play with, okay? So let's see what we can say about the energy distribution in that case, okay? So single particle from three-body decay. So in this case, of course, already in the rest frame, there is a distribution which looks like this. It has an endpoint, okay, which depends on the masses of the heavy particle and the other particles in the process, okay? So that's this maximum value in the rest frame. So I take this and then I boost the parent. Okay, so this was the rest frame of the parent. So when I boost, of course, what's going to happen is the resulting distribution is going to go beyond this endpoint in the rest frame. Okay, but what we realize is that, so again, this is the lab frame now. Okay, here's the endpoint in the rest frame. So the distribution does go beyond the endpoint. But what we could show, and I mean, this proof is not so simple, but the result is that the peak of the lab frame distribution, that still remains below the endpoint in the rest frame. Okay, so that's an observation which we actually used to make a distinction between what I call dark matter models with Z3 symmetry. In the case of Z3 symmetry, the heavy particle charged under that dark matter symmetry is allowed to decay into one visible plus two dark matter, as opposed to Z2 case where the heavy particle charged under the Z2, the dark matter symmetry, can only give one dark matter. Okay? So we were trying to distinguish the cases where, some heavy particle decays into one visible and one invisible, try to distinguish that from one visible and two invisible using this result here. Okay, and combining it with the two-body result that I showed you. Okay, so let me, I think I went through all of this, so let me just flash this slide, but let me stop here.
So how much does it depend on the signal to noise? Did you try to see what happens if you start changing the signal to noise?
So actually for the, Yeah, I don't have the plots here. Anyway, these are old. But we actually tried to change that S over B. So of course, if it goes down, things are going to get worse. So,
of course, the question is how
much worse? No, of course. So yeah, I don't remember the numbers. I think in our paper we may have actually showed plots.
Yeah, let me ask you a question.
So I think
for
this.
When you discover it with 5 sigma certainty, how well would you be able
to... I think at that point, yeah, so it's probably, this is not going to be a good measurement. Because,
so... Would you be able to say, I mean, even at that point, even 30% would be a good measurement.
Right.
Do you remember, or...?
Yeah, I like to look up my paper. So, I mean, in general, our idea was that this would be, yeah, post discovery obviously, but high S or B. Now but right after discovery.
No, discovery, as we know, right? Given the bounds, you won't be able to have a lot of sigma.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah.
You won't have a lot of let's say you have something that would just reach.
Let's go to 100 TeV.
Yeah, well.
No, but I think I hear you. So I think here it's already 1,000, which is probably ruled out. If I take the bound of whatever, 1.4 TeV.
Yeah.
Then I think I have a feeling even with 3,000 inverse femto bonds, it might be looking tough. I think the main issue is we already said this, but the issue is that this peak here, this energy peak, it's rather broad. Okay, so and that's the reason why you need higher S over B. So as compared to, let's say, the Breitwinkler peaks, they are of course narrower. So in the Breitwinkler case, as you know, with the Higgs, right, the S over B is actually kind of lousy, right? But still, you can get the Higgs mass. So these peaks are more spread, and so to kind of for the peak to stand out, you really need high S over B. Yes?
So maybe you mentioned this at the beginning, but is it possible to apply this energy peak fitting function to a massless particle like Higgs goes to gamma gamma?
Sure, yeah. So in fact, the main result is for a massless particle. So for Higgs to gamma gamma, you can apply it, but the point is that in that case, you're just much better off just doing the invariant mass, right, of the two photons, okay? So, right, and get the usual Breitwinkler peak. And that peak, of course, like I was saying, it's much going to be much narrower, so you're much better off doing. The case was that one child particle is visible, but the other one, let's say it's invisible or partially visible, right? So the top quark is bottom and W. Bottom is basically massless. Okay, so I'm going to look at the energy peak of the bottom. But the point is that the W boson, it's either only partially visible, for example, if it goes to neutrinos, right? So in that case, the idea was if I don't use the W reconstruction, just using the bottom quark energy, what can I get? And of course, in the SUSY case, really the second child particle is really invisible, like neutralino, right? So bottom quark decay into bottom neutralino. And now I can only use the bottom energy. So our idea was to see how you can get the bottom quark mass using that, right? So cases where the decay is fully visible, and then you're just better off invariant mass. Even there, I want to say that the Higgs to gamma gamma, the nice thing is at leading order, there's no combinatorics involved, right? So you see two photons and they are coming from the Higgs, and right? But if you try to do this for the top quark where the W decays hadronically, so you have B plus two jets on one side and B plus two jets on the other side. Now you have many, many jets, okay? So when you reconstruct the W, you end up combinatorics problem, because you don't know which two jets came from that W, right? And in that case, again, the full reconstruction is non-trivial, okay? But again, Higgs to gamma gamma or Z to E plus E minus, you can really have, you know, events with just only two photons or only electron and positron, and then you're fine. But yeah, anytime you have jets, there is always going to be ISR, and so you don't know whether a jet came from the DK, from the W, or it came from ISR. Right? So in that case, again, our method may be useful, because again, we're not combining anything.
Okay, thank you.